tulee pelaa sen.
I don't care, Justin.
Same story, Helen.
Oh yeah.
Go back one paragraph. I did suggest at this time that at the time that this phase of Helen's illumination, we call it the gorgeous technicolor phase, would develop into an even profounder, more natural, and virtually permanent state. And this soon happened. In fact, is it possible for me to describe that state? Perhaps it would be useful to summarize here the mentioning of the four aspects, or moments, or stages, to which we have often divided artificially, for the sake of description, for the essential experience. One, the void. This is the key, the indispensable basis, and means clearly seeing at will, even all the time, that right here and one, right here, one is totally headless, bodiless, mindless, and in fact nothing whatever. Two, love. The result of this absolute contraction is an equal and opposite expansion, a great outward surge, which leaves nobody and nothing out. Three, the alone, as thus all-embracing one is the one quite solitary, free, independent. These foolish words can give no idea of the homecoming. And four, mystery.
What are you reading from, Douglas?
It's the story of Helen. Story of Helen by Douglas Harding. And four, mystery. Thus, actually, to be the alone, self-originating, and self-sufficient is unspeakable wonder. These four may give some slight clue to an experience which is, of course, neither Helen's nor mine, but that of the one who is ourself. But really, they won't do at all. They only import complications into what is perfect clarity and simplicity. Between this clear seeing and the finest description of it, there must always remain an infinite gap. It isn't merely that words can't reveal it, they're what hide it. Of course, a certain amount of talk helped at the beginning. Just being with Helen, ready with encouragement and understanding when she needed them, and the occasional explanation of some puzzle, did make a good deal of difference. And I was able to put her onto those few, but very few, books which have been written out of first-hand experience and protect her temporarily from the thousands that have not. Introduce her to Eckhart, Ruse Broek, Rumi, the Upanishads, Shantara, Ramana Maharshi, Lao Tzu, Hung Po, and Hu Hai. Notice I was careful not to plug any one tradition. It was imperative that Helen should find her own affinity. In fact, she was unable to pick and choose between them. Each displayed for her an indispensable aspect of a single clear pattern. Only perhaps I should add, Ramana Maharshi has a very special appeal for us both. Helen devoured these books, ignoring always the merely geographical and historical accidents and grasping the common essence. She had no real questions to ask me then. None at all. A miracle remains for us both how suddenly and completely this wonderful thing has happened. But even miracles have some background, and obviously this one called for further investigation. How was it possible for Helen so rudely to jump the spiritual cue? We thought of the years of anxious searching, of austerity, marathons, of meditation, which are traditionally reckoned the price of any real illumination, and we marveled. Was Helen one of those very rare exceptions to the rule? Then we discovered, not, of course, an explanation of her gift and her grace, but something of its history. She'd been a dark horse all along. Understandably, there'd been throughout childhood and youth the flashes, the brief but lovely previews of heaven, but in addition, something much more remarkable and significant. From her earliest school days onwards, she'd been in the habit of going off on her own, swimming, rambling, just sitting, and this solitude became more and more an essential part of her life pattern. Latterly, her beach hut had provided a convenient retreat where she used to sit quite alone for hours on summer evenings and at weekends. I asked her what she had thought about. She replied, bless her, just as if it were a stupid question to have asked. Why? Nothing. I just sat. Dozing? I inquired. Of course not. Quite wide awake. With an empty mind. Just like that? It's true, the fact that there was something odd about this behavior had already dawned upon her. Her friends were inclined to regard it as self-indulgent or even morbid. Not that this had at all deterred Helen. The pleasure of merely sitting there was its own reward and increasingly necessary to her well-being. But certainly it never occurred to her that this state of no mind might have some religious or mystical significance, or was much more than an idiosyncrasy. If anyone had told her then, as I did later, that after months and years of sitting meditation, a yogin would be doing well if he could avoid all wandering of thoughts for a few minutes, whereas Helen was able to shed them for as long as she liked. Why, if anyone had told her this, she would have thought he was just teasing. I don't mean to imply, of course, that this strange accomplishment of hers was sitting meditation in the full sense of that term, or spiritually mature. It was, as yet, far from self-aware. But what better rehearsal for the self-awareness she now enjoys could be imagined? Well, that is Helen's story to date. In brief, it will be pointed out, of course, that having got off to a wonderful start, she still has a long, long way to go. In one sense, it's true, there's no end to this, but in a much deeper sense, it's the lie. She has nowhere to go. She's where she has always been, here. What's more to the point, she has the nerve to see it, and to say she sees it, and to live every moment accordingly. That's all that matters. for all genuine seekers, and particularly for us in the West, Helen should prove a huge encouragement. She doesn't want to be known, or unknown, for that matter, and is virtually indifferent to praise or ridicule. But she agreed that others should take heart from her story. From this account of what can happen to a quite ordinary person, in fact, of course, none of us, and certainly not Helen, is quite ordinary, and has happened to so recently right here, under our noses, where almost everyone interested in these things suffers from a chronic spiritual inferiority complex. We all know the sort of thing. It can't be done here. You have to go off to some cave in the Himalayas, or some Japanese monastery, and there you have to spend months just learning how to sit and breathe properly, and then you have to sit in meditation for perhaps the rest of your life under the guidance of the right master, and how difficult he is to find, before you can hope for enlightenment. Even then, the chances are you'll miss it. Well, at least you'll get off to a flying start in your next life, or the next, but one.
What is the last word?
One. Helen is splendidly confident. Only once, right at the start, has she entertained the slightest doubts regarding her illumination, and then they pass very quickly. Comparing the immense efforts of certain Zen monks to gain some glimpse of their original face with her own apparently effortless and clear seeing of it, she didn't know what to think, understandably enough. Her confidence doesn't arise from what she understands, but from what she sees. And anything can be doubted except this. How many more heavens there are, I don't know. Even if there's only one who, reading her story, finds the courage to follow her over the brink of the precipice, she will bless Helen infinitely. At the end of his story. The Inner Shrine by Satchel, Sufi poet saint of Sindh. We have seen the Kaaba in the heart, so what need is there to go to Mecca? My mind is the mosque, so why worship in any other shrine? In every artery is he. So why pronounce the creed? There's a big article on Ramanuja. Another one, Christmas Humphreys.
Mm-hmm. Who is Krishna?
Christmas Humphreys. He's a big author. The eminent author of this article has not so much studied the question of the acclimatization of Buddhism in the West as lived with it. As founder president of the London Buddhist Society, this is the acclimatization of Buddhism in the West. Another big article. And this is all about Buddhism. The Chan Master, Chi Cheng. The Chan Shout. And then the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 3. Arjuna said, if you consider understanding superior to action, O scourge of the foes, why then, you of beautiful locks, do you urge me to this fearful action? Note, when told that action cannot lead one to liberation, it is natural to say, all right then, let me renounce action and just meditate. Someone said this to the Maharshi, and he replied, try it and see. It was all right if you can, but you will find that your own mind demands activity. Arjuna falls into the same mistake. And in chapter 5, verse 5, is given the same answer. It is further explained to him that the remedy is not inactivity, which is not possible to man, but egoless activity. This also the Maharshi used to say. As he put it, it is not doing that has to be abjured, but only the illusion that you are the door. Verse 2. With what seems to be unclear speech, you confuse my mind, as it were. Please tell me the one way by which I may attain the supreme good. 3. Sri Bhagavan said, in this world a twofold path was taught by me of old. O blameless one, the path of knowledge for introverts and the path of action for extroverts. You have a Sanskrit word for introvert, extrovert. No, Arjuna as a Kshatriya was directed to the path of action, but it is not to be supposed that less was therefore demanded of him. As he was told in the previous chapter, he is expected to transcend the polarities and the three gunas and thereby realize identity. But, as Dr. Radhakrishna says in his commentary, this distinction is not ultimate, for all men are in different degrees both introverts and extroverts. Unquote. As the Maharshi said, as quoted in our October 1964 editorial, the four margas, karma, bhakti, yoga, and jnana, are not exclusive of one another. Each is, however, described separately in classical works, only to convey an idea of the appropriate aspect of God to appeal readily to the aspirant according to his disposition. Verse 4. Not by refraining from activity does a man attain freedom from action, nor by mere renunciation does he gain perfection. 5. Indeed, no one can remain even for a moment really inactive. For one is driven helplessly to action by the qualities of nature. 6. The deluded person who controls his physical organs, but lets his mind brood on the objects of sense, is known as a hypocrite. 7. He it is who excels, Arjuna, who controls his senses with his mind and employs his physical organs in karma yoga without attachment. 8. Perform your allotted duty. The action is better than inaction. Even the preservation of life in the body is impossible without action. 9. People in this world are fettered by action unless it is performed as a sacrifice. Therefore, O son of Kunti, let your action be sacrifice free from attachment. Note, it is to be remembered that the English word sacrifice means etymologically make sacred or sanctify. This Sanskrit word is used in the Gita with a wide meaning covering sanctify and sacrifice in the modern meaning and even ritualistic sacrifice. It implies the dedication of one's actions to God. 10. In the beginning, Prajapati, as creator, made men together with sacrifice and said, by this you shall propagate and it shall be your cow of plenty. That means cows are before people. He's referring to the cow. Right. Eleven. Nourish the gods through this and let them nourish you. thus nourishing one another, you shall attain the highest good. No, here, of course, there's no reference to God as Supreme Being, but to establishing harmony with higher powers, which will be reflected by harmony on earth. 12. Nourished by sacrifice, the gods will bestow on you the enjoyments you desire. He who enjoys their gifts without offering to them in return is indeed a thief. 13. The righteous who eat the food remaining from sacrifice are absolved of all sins. But the impious who cook for themselves alone eat sin. Whoa. No, that food should be offered first in sacrifice and only afterwards partaken of. Analogously with all other enjoyments of life. See also chapter 9, verse 27, for a still more emphatic assertion of this. 14. Creatures are the product of food. Food is the product of rain. Rain is the product of sacrifice. And sacrifice the product of action. So rain only comes. Rain comes by sacrifice. It's raining now, I think.
Oh, we had rain dances, right? The Indians had rain dances.
Well, everybody wanted rain at some point. And then they don't want it at some point. A lot of India is going to be flooded in 2050. Yeah, the New York Times.
Yes, 2050?
2050, yeah.
Bombay.
Bombay's gone, yeah. They had it in the New York Times, a map with all these different places.
Looks like we would be gone too. We're right on the water.
Well, I have water here, you know, because I have the Great Lakes nearby. We always have water. Okay. 15. Action is a product of the Vedas, and they of the imperishable. Hence, the all-pervading Brahman is ever-present in sacrifice. 16. He who does not follow the cycle thus set in motion, O son of Pritha, is sinful and self-indulgent and lives in vain. 17. For him, however, who rejoices only in the self, is gratified with the self and content with the self, no action is incumbent. 18. He has nothing to gain by actions done, or to lose by those undone. He is not dependent on anyone for the achievement of any object. Note, Krishna had been speaking of the necessary harmonization of life. In these last two verses, he reminds Arjuna that this does not apply to one whose life is already harmonized by absorption in the self. 19. Therefore, without attachment, perform always the actions that are incumbent, for by disinterested activity, man attained the Supreme. 20. It was by action that Janaka and others attained perfection. Perform actions, therefore, you also, as an example to mankind. Note, Janaka is a legendary king who had attained enlightenment. He is also the father of Sita, Lord Rama's wife. They said there were many Janakas. There were many King Janakas. 21. For whatever a great man does, others imitate. Whatever standard he sets up, the people emulate. 22. For me, O son of Pritha, there is no action incumbent in the three worlds, nor anything unattained to attain, yet I do act. 23. If ever I cease from unwearied action, O son of Pritha, Men, in all ways, follow my example. 24. If I cease from action, these worlds would fall in ruin. I should cause social confusion and bring destruction on these people. 25. As the ignorant act from attachment, O Bharata, so should the wise act without attachment, as an example to the people. 26. The wise man should not unsettle the minds of the ignorant who are attached to action. He also should engage in action, but as a form of yoga, and urge others to action. 27. When all actions are performed by the qualities of nature, only he who is confused by the ego sense imagines himself to be the actor. 28. But he, O mighty armed, who discerns the qualities and their modes of action, is never attached, knowing that it is the qualities that act upon the qualities. 29. Those who are deluded by the qualities of nature become attached to the actions produced by them. But he who knows the whole should not unsettle the ignorant who sees only a part. 30. Fight, therefore, surrendering all your actions to me, with mind centered on me, or on the self, without desire or egoism, and from your fever of doubt set free. 31. Those who constantly follow this teaching of mine with firm faith and without cavilling are set free from activity. But know, those who despise my teaching and reject it, to be deluded as to wisdom, senselessly doomed to perdition. So what is perdition?
Be lost.
That's all?
That's
your worst. Worse. No, just lost?
Well, bad, you know, lost in a bad way.
33. Even an enlightened man acts according to his nature. All creatures conform to their nature. What can restraint do? 34. Each sense has its objects of attraction and aversion, but one should not succumb to these, for they are impediments on the path. 35. Better one's own dharma, however imperfect, than that of another, though well performed. Better even to die following one's own dharma, for that of another is perilous. Note, this is considered one of the fundamental verses of the Gita, that one should follow one's own nature or destiny and not try to emulate that of others. The word translated imperfect can mean either imperfectly performed or inferior. It applies primarily to social position. It implies also that one should develop according to one's own nature and not emulate that of some other person one envies or admires. 36. Arjuna said, but what is it that drives a man to sin, even against his will, as though under compulsion, Krishna, of the Rishnis? 37. Sri Bhagavan said, it is desire and anger born of the quality of rajas, utterly blinding the sinful. Know this to be the enemy. 38. As fire is concealed by smoke, as a mirror by dust, as an embryo in the womb, so is this teaching concealed by it. 39. Knowledge is darkened, O son of Kunti, by this eternal foe of the knower of the form of desire, an insatiable conflagration. 40. senses, mind, manas, and intellect, buddhi, are said to be its abode, obscuring wisdom through them. It deludes the embodiment. 41. Therefore, Prince of Bharata, control your senses first. Thus shall you destroy this destroyer of knowledge and discrimination. 42. Mighty, they say, are the senses, mightier than these, the mind, mightier than that, the intellect, but mightier still is he. No, the he is ambiguous. It may refer to the spirit or as a warning to desire. The following verse suggests that it is the former, meaning that is intended. 43. Thus knowing him, who is beyond the intellect, O mighty of arms, control yourself by the self, and slay the enemy and the form of desire, hard though it may be. Here ends the third chapter entitled The Yoga of Action.
So this was written by who, this article?
You know, there was that Professor Kulkarni and Arthur Osborne.
Yes.
So from these, there's a book, the Bhagavad Gita, that the ashram publishes. So they went through the whole Gita, Professor Kulkarni and Arthur Osborne.
Oh, I have seen that.
Yeah, so they first, you know, serialized it. They say it here, yeah. They first serialized it, and then they... Here's Swami Omkar. There's a book on him.
Swami Omkar?
Yeah. That's one of the book reviews. Cosmic flashes, cosmic fast, and the hours of silence, self-realization now and here, are simply collections of observations and reflections of Swami Omkar, mostly written as the fruit of lengthy periods of fasting. They are not on sale, but are donated free to those who write for them to his ashram, Sri Shanti Ashram, via Shankarvaram, East Godavari District. Swami Omkar is perhaps best known for his peace propaganda, but it is not the usual, rather insipid variety, since he always insists that peace must be found within oneself before it can be spread abroad. As he says in Cosmic Flashes, peace is the birthright of every soul. Nay, the soul is peace. Santoyam Atma, says the Upanishad. With every inhalation of yours, try to take in peace, and try to give out peace only with every exhalation. Your very life should become peace. He who thus realizes peace, realizes God. For verily the two are one. Unquote. He is not a guru in the usual sense of giving initiation and upadesha, but many who visit him revere him as such. He worships God in all he sees in the ocean, comparing it to the ocean of reality, the Atman, and the breath that is the source of all breath, the infinite that is manifesting itself in life as a process of silent, slow, and steady growth towards the goal. He is even capable of seeing God in the ugly and sinful. He sees everywhere the face of God in health and in sickness, in good fortune and ill. He has a delightful little fragment on the mosquito that stings him as a divine reminder. He speaks of cosmic consciousness as something not to be acquired anew, but that is possessed by every soul eternally. He exclaims, impossible to forget God. How glorious! Every sound expresses him. Every manifestation springs from him. He longs to communicate his experience that God is here and everywhere, that he is eternally one with us, and that all we have to do is to be aware of his all-pervasive presence. That is a golden thread running through his book, that we have to feel the interpenetrating presence of the Absolute, that religion is to come face to face with God that is within and without, that real happiness is only in union with God, the indwelling light. He speaks also of the power of thought. What we are is the result of our thinking. Therefore, it can be said that we form our own destiny by our thoughts. By being master of one's thoughts, one becomes master of one's destiny. In Cosmic Fast, the Swami has much to say about the conscious realization and recognition of the infinite and eternal light, omnipresent and interpenetrating truth. He speaks of the boundless love of God, a perennial flow of the living water of life, light and love. He pleads, let us be worthy channels to receive his never-ending floods of power and blessing. Fasting has led him to ecstasy, which he declares is more than purifying the body, it is purifying our inmost being in the stillness of our own soul, in the sanctuary of our heart, feeling divinity within by centering on the Most High. Overcome by the presence, he prays, Lord, as I am feeling thy presence now in all inspired intensity, let me continue to feel it thus forever. Let me not forget thee even for a single moment. Thou art my life, my soul, and my all in all. With thee I am complete. I need nothing else beside thee, for in having thee, who art in all beings, I am having everything. That's all. Book review. There's a nice picture of him there. Obituary, Sri A. Shivarama Reddier first came to the ashram in 1931 and remained there ever since, a continuous service of 34 years. Even as a boy, he was inspired by the Tamil Advaitic songs of Sri Achyuta Swami of Polar. After the death of his wife, quite early in life, he turned his attention entirely to the spiritual path. He was initiated by a disciple of Sri Achyuta Swami and spent 3 years wandering about India on foot, visiting Swamis and holy places. In the course of his wanderings, he came to Ramanashramam, and Bhagavan's powerful gaze dispelled all remaining doubts and captivated him completely. He gave up wandering and decided to remain here. And through Bhagavan's grace, the Sarvadhikari put him in charge of the ashram book depot, a charge which he retained within a few days of his passing. His grave manner and complete devotion to Bhagavan won him the respect of other devotees. After a short illness, he passed away at the age of 70. In his village of Uttarameru, where he was taken by his daughter, his absence in the ashram will long be felt. May he rest in peace at the feet of Bhagavan. Introducing K.K. Nambiar, first came to Bhagavan as long as 1933. He could only stay for an hour on this first occasion, but was captivated by from the very start. Much as he would have liked to stay on in the ashram, he was unable to do so, being a professional engineer. The study exemplified the pattern which Bhagavan always recommended of a man living and working in the world by remembering and making sadhana simultaneously. He has since risen to the very top of his profession. He was a chief engineer of the state of Madras.
City engineer.
Which is a big job, right? Then Madras, the whole southern India, right?
They're called city engineers.
Madras Presidency, there was
yeah.
no Andhra Pradesh.
Yeah. So, I went to his house and everything. Showed me where he saw the star moving in 1950. 50, April 14th. His son said, Appa, look it. And they saw it. And then he packed his car and got in and drove to the ashram because he knew Bhagavan. That was the other Bhagavan. I got movies from him also. You know, there's one movie he never gave to the ashram. He took movies because he could afford it. He had a cinematographer come with him and take movies and everything.
That's a good thing in those days.
In those days, and so he could afford it, you know. And I don't know, so there's one movie he never gave to the ashram, and it was with, you know, Bhagavan was coming around the guest house for men, and then he was sort of ambushed by the cinematographer. In fact, I think he was holding it. And his wife put his head on Bhagavan's feet. You're not supposed to touch his body, you know. His wife stood before him, got down and put her head on his feet. And then he gave the camera to his wife, and then he went and done it. And he said, did you get it? He wasn't confident, so he did it again, you know.
Yeah.
So since you're not supposed to touch Bhagavan or anything, he never gave that.
Oh, really.
So, but his wife told me, I got it from their son, in fact. I'll go to Delhi.
You he had showed it here.
Yeah. Well, it's in the archival film. It's in the archival film. So the wife told me on his deathbed, he used to keep a projector alongside. And he would just project that one scene over and over again.
And
before Bhagavan and everything. But they never gave it to the ashram. You know.
Yeah,
it's the rules what he did. After he's still alive here when they write this. After he first met his first meeting with Bhagavan, he prayed silently and fervently to Bhagavan for more opportunity to see him. The prayer was answered by apparent coincidences. The District Board of North Arcot was subdivided and K.K. Navier was appointed the board engineer for the new district with headquarters in Tiruvannamalai. He was now able to visit the ashram almost daily. And this also, he conformed to a pattern that was often seen by choice of destiny among Bhagavan's disciples, that is, for a new devotee to be kept in close physical proximity to Bhagavan for some time and then to be sent out into the world to cope with life and apply the spiritual viewpoint that had been acquired. K.K. Namir is one of those who came through the test valiantly. However, far between his visits to the ashram might be, he remained centered on Bhagavan. Since Bhagavan left the body, he has also remained a staunch supporter of the ashram. K.K. Nambiar was from the beginning peculiarly receptive to influences from Bhagavan. The following incident related by him in the Golden Jubilee souvenir in 1949 is an example of this. One evening in the year 1936, when I visited the ashram, I decided to ask an important question of Bhagavan concerning certain spiritual practices. But amidst the solemn hours of Veda Parayana, in the evening and during meditation that followed, I could not make up my mind to ask the question and returned home somewhat disappointed. Early next morning, when I was lying half awake, Sri Bhagavan appeared before me in a dream and answered the very question which I had failed to put to him the previous evening.
Yes.
And before he vanished, he also told me that he wanted a notebook. I said that I had only one readily available and that it was of octavo pocket size. Octavo means?
Eight.
So how can you have a notebook with eight sizes?
1, 2, 3, 4.
And
you can,
it's
weird.
Octavo.
Yes.
Octavo. He said that would do.
Or it could have been for music with octaves instead of lines.
Oh, yeah.
Could have been octaves.
So he told Bhagavan the dream, that's all I had, and Bhagavan said, that would do. I woke up with a pleasant thrill. the dream or vision, which one may call it, had made such a deep impression on my mind that I could not delay carrying out the behest, however strange it might seem. After an early bath and ablutions, I traced out the notebook and hurried to the ashram, prostrating myself before Bhagavan as usual. I handed over the notebook to him. He received it with a smile and asked me why I had brought it to him. So I told him in a whisper all about my dream. Immediately he called his personal attendant, the late Madhava Swami, and remarked, "Didn't I ask you yesterday evening to get a good notebook to write out a Malayalam translation of the Sanskrit text of the Sri Ramana Gita in? You didn't bring one. Well, here is Nambiar, who brought it for me. It seems he had a dream in which I asked for the notebook, and he had brought it." In the same article, he records another dream which is of great interest, not only in itself, but as an illustration of how Bhagavan would sometimes instruct one devotee through another. Quote, "On another occasion in the same year, I dreamt of the Maharshi seated on the couch with a number of devotees seated on the floor and in meditation. Among them, I recognized a young devotee from Goa, seated in Padmasana and doing pranayama, breath control. I think his name was Sridhar. While he was doing pranayama, I saw sparks rising from the base of his spine up to his head. Bhagavan, who was watching him, said, 'There is no need for all this gymnastics with breath control. It is easier and safer to follow the method of self-inquiry as enunciated by me.' Next morning, when I went to the ashram, I sought out the young Goanese Swami. I had no previous acquaintance with him, and I had no occasion to speak to him before. I gave him a full account of the dream I had had. He was visibly moved, and somewhat to my embarrassment, embraced me with delight in the North Indian fashion." They don't do it in the South, you know. "He said, 'Brother, I was all the while waiting for an opportunity to ask Bhagavan whether I should continue or give up this practice of pranayama which I have been steadily carrying on for several years past. Indeed, last night while sitting in the presence of Bhagavan, I was eagerly waiting for an opportunity to put the question to him, but couldn't find a suitable occasion. Now there is no need to ask him about it, since he has answered me through you. At present, K.K. Namir is living in Bombay, but he remains in close touch with the ashram and the other devotees.'" He had a big house in Adyar, right on the river there. You know, that's where he retired. I guess he moved back to